Hello, everybody. My name is Bezena Hinton, and I welcome you to the session on Someone Else's Problem, a case study in regulatory failure. And I welcome today Shauna Ferris. Shauna has worked in the life insurance, banking, and superannuation industries. In 1993, she joined the staff of the Actuarial Studies Department at Macquarie University, where she's now a senior lecturer. She's particularly interested in prudential regulation and enterprise risk management. She was the author of the solvency chapter of the control cycle textbook, Understanding Actuarial Management. Since she believes it's important to learn from other people's experiences, she's written several case studies which are included in the course material for part two subjects. We're delighted you're here with us today, Shauna, and we look forward to your presentation. I'm sure it'll be really interesting. Shauna's going to run this presentation as an interactive session. And so as she talks, please could you raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll make sure the microphone is passed to you so that you can add a comment. Or if you've got any other comments on the way through, please do raise your hand, because she is going to take up most of the time. There'll be a little bit of time left at the end for discussion, but that's why it's really important if you want to add something or make a comment, please just raise your hand on the way through. And as you do, if you want to make a comment, please can you say your name into the microphone first. Oh, thank you. I'll let you get on with it now, Sean.
Thank you, Bezena. It's nice to see so many people here interested in regulatory failure. When we talk about a failure of regulation, I'm not just suggesting that every insolvency represents a failure of regulation. In a healthy, competitive system, we would expect that some insurance companies will fail from time to time. And that's not really a problem as long as policyholder losses are limited. So the aim of regulation is really about protecting the policyholders from serious losses. If a company goes broke and has 99% of its liabilities covered, it's not such a serious problem. But the case study I'm doing today, Guaranteed Security Life, is a spectacular example of a regulatory failure. As you can see from the diagram, when they went broke, they had liabilities of $620 million, but assets of only $230 million. Quite a large gap. This company was a Florida life insurance company. They had about 56,000 policyholders when they went broke. Most of their policyholders were low or middle income people, mostly retirees. And as you can see, if they had $620 million in liabilities and 56,000 policyholders, the average amount was about $11,000 per policyholder. This company went into receivership in 1991. So the assets were 37% of the liabilities. And Guarantee Security Life is widely considered to be the most inappropriately named insurance company in history. What could sound safer than guaranteed security? So let's have a look at how it happened. Now, there are always going to be some people who like to gamble with other people's money, and the history of life insurance is filled with the history of people who decide that the easiest way to get their hands on a lot of other people's money is to set up a little life insurance company. You might be able to think of some Australian examples of companies where the main purpose of the owner of the company seemed to be to gamble with other people's money. I'm not going to say which ones I think they are because I don't want to be sued, but perhaps some of you might be able to think of some examples from the past. Maybe the older ones can remember companies like this. So to prevent this happening, we need to have a prudential system where there are specified processes and watchdogs to protect the policyholders. We need legislators and regulators and accounting standards and auditors and actuaries and rating agencies and a legal system that punishes people who do the wrong thing, or give some redress to the people who've been injured. So how well did all these prudential regulations work at Guaranteed Security Life? Fortunately, I always love it when there's a big collapse, that there's some kind of inquiry where basically everyone gets a chance to give their version of what went wrong, and everyone blames everybody else and explains why their own actions were particularly beyond reproach. So in this particular case, there was a congressional inquiry into guaranteed security life. And this is the point of view that was presented by the Florida Department of Insurance Commissioner. Guaranteed security was almost from the beginning a massive fraud, aided and abetted by blue ribbon brokers and licensed professionals, motivated by their own self-interest. The fraud of guarantee was a carefully orchestrated bank robbery, but the thieves disguised themselves with the help of accountants, brokers, and lawyers rather than wearing silk stocking masks. They operated like early 20th century robber barons, cloaking their thievery in the guise of a sound business organization. And I'd have to say, there's some truth in this. There are some people who have robbed money from insurance companies. You might remember the case of Martin Frankel, who was an American guy who bought 8 small life insurance companies in the southern part of the United States, stole $200 million from them, and sent them all broke. And when he was caught, he went to jail for a very, very long time. Now, the people who ran Guaranteed Security Life, they did fairly well out of this personally, but none of them went to jail because they could argue that what they'd done was technically legal. So this is obviously a better way of gambling with other people's money. The regulators at the congressional inquiry said that they were deceived by these evil people who had done all these fraudulent practices, but as we'll see later, there was a certain lack of credibility in this claim. The regulators probably had a reasonably good idea of what was going on, I think. So in this, I'm just going to briefly describe who the owners of the company were, what their marketing plan was, how they dealt with new business strain, their investment policy, how they managed their capital requirements, some problems arising from investments with affiliates, and the aftermath of the collapse. The owners were Mark Sanford, who was, according to his own testimony, an investment genius. That's what he told his policyholders anyway. As we'll see, he was possibly overly optimistic in assessing his own abilities. William Blackburn, who was the gregarious marketing guy. They worked together as brokers, and reading between the lines of some of the testimony, I get the impression that they were not perhaps entirely successful in their previous occupation. They set up a company called Transmark, which was wholly owned by the two of them. And Transmark bought GSL, which was at the time a small, modestly profitable insurance company with assets of about $100 million. They paid about $7 million on a, quote, very leveraged basis. So you think about it. With maybe $1 million of their own money, $6 million borrowed, they managed to get control of $100 million worth of assets. So a question, if you were a regulator, would you have allowed these two guys to buy an insurance company?
I think Sean is looking for a response here. Anyone wants to make a response?
Does anyone? No. Okay, why not? What would you say? They don't have enough experience, but they have an excellent management team who's been running the company for years. They don't have their own experience, but surely they can hire in someone. The seller of the company is really keen. He's getting $7 million. He's getting a pretty good price for the company. He wants to sell it. If you block this, isn't the seller going to be a bit annoyed? After all, there's nothing known against these guys, so willing seller, experienced team, nothing known against them. But you're right, they don't have much experience. And when we look at their business plan later, there are certainly some cause for concern. And I think the problem is that they were getting 100% control of the company. I don't know what you guys think, but I think the Financial Sector Shareholding Act of 1998 is one of Australia's best pieces of legislation,
in relation to life insurance because it says no one can own more than 15% of a life insurance company. And I think that's one of the biggest safeguards for policyholders. It's not a good idea to have one person controlling an insurance company, or even two in this case. Wasn't an issue in Florida. They didn't have any rules like that. So let's look at Mr. Blackburn's experience. This is his testimony to the subsequent commission, where the senators asked him about his experience in a company. He didn't really have much experience in running the business, and he was willing to jump in and learn. Unfortunately, soon after the takeover, Mr. Sanford and Blackburn decided that the existing GSL management was totally uncooperative with their planned business plans. So they sacked them. Mr. Blackburn became the CEO. Mr. Sanford became the investment manager and chairman of the board. He put his brother in as the CFO, and his Blackburn's soon-to-be wife became the head of marketing, and Sanford's wife was on the board of directors of the holding company. So you can see it was a little family business here. Of course, this wouldn't be allowed under our legislation, would it? Because we have rules about these things. Fit and proper person requirements. So the question is, why did the Florida insurance regulator give these guys a license? They asked the Florida Insurance Commissioner this at the subsequent inquiry, and he said there was no known reason to deny them. Over the period between 1979 to 1987, 130 new insurance companies were registered in Florida. That's life in general. And the insurance commissioner said that this was a sign of a flourishing insurance industry. I'm not sure what the population of Florida is, but 130 new insurance companies seems a bit excessive. I know they were trying to encourage competition, but I don't think the number of insurance companies is a good measure of how well your insurance industry is doing. They asked, as you can see in the comment, someone from the newspaper interviewed staff members, and they said, as long as they put up the money to capitalize the company and are not convicted felons, we'll give them a certificate of authority. The staffer who asked not to be identified says, you can tell from their business plans that they have no idea what they're getting into. Now, I don't want to, some people think I'm unduly cynical, okay? But after I read this, I thought, you know, these guys were really very willing to give certificates of authority. So I rummaged around through a database trying to find out everything I could about the insurance commissioner and came up with this little extract from the newspaper where apparently someone claimed that for paying $10,000 in campaign contributions to the insurance commissioner, his license would be expedited so that he could set up his insurance company more quickly. But of course, there's no suggestion that this was played any part in guaranteed security life. But it is a worry in the United States. The role of insurance commissioner is filled by someone who's elected, and they need campaign funds. Now, what... There were two regulators during the period that... Mr. Gunther was the insurance commissioner at the time GSL was licensed. It was a different... He was replaced by Tom Gallagher a bit later on, so when GSL collapsed, it was Tom Gallagher, who subsequently, I think, became governor of Florida. So it's a insurance commission is a stepping stone to higher things. This is how Mr. Blackburn explained his corporate objectives to the commission. He said, I didn't really want to be in the insurance business, so why did he get into it? It was because we're money managers. He and Mark Sanford wanted to manage some money. And insurance companies have a lot of money, which is invested in these boring, conservative, dull-type products, which are underperforming. So if we thought, if we buy the insurance company and manage the money, we'll be able to get a much better return. We'll earn some good investment fees. So his basic plan was to obtain as much money as possible as quickly as possible so that he could invest the assets to provide a high return, which is probably not a good business plan for most insurance companies. So let's think, if this was your business plan and you wanted to get as much money for your life insurance company
as possible, as quickly as possible, what would you use for your marketing plan? High commission, definitely, good idea. Marketing to the agents. What kind of product do you think you should sell? Single premium policies, yep. Give good guarantees, that way you'll get a lot of money in the door. You guys are obviously have potential here. It's a worry, isn't it?
For those of you who weren't here at the beginning, this is an interactive session, so please contribute.
You can yell out answers if you like. High income? High income people are too smart. They have financial advisors. We want people who are trusting. Florida has a lot of retired people. This was GSL's initial marketing plan. They revised it later. Single premium annuities, biggest amount of money in through the door. Guaranteed high interest rate, at least for the first year. During the inquiry, it appeared that some customers apparently believed that the guarantee lasted for longer than 1 year, but this was probably just a misunderstanding. they had the lowest rates in the market. Excellent commission rates. They built up their sales force really rapidly, not just in Florida, but throughout the country. And, of course, large surrender penalties so that people don't feel tempted to actually take their money out at any time. So if this marketing plan is actually traditionally commonly used by people who want to get hold of other people's money. If you go right back in the history of life insurance, there was a company called the West Middlesex, which set up in England in 1843. They had exactly the same marketing plan, and they did almost exactly the same thing with the money once they got it. Now, the question is, if somebody set up a company like this in Australia, what protection would there be, what warning would there be for the customers to warn them off investing in a company like this one? Have we got anything that would protect our consumers from somebody that sells the cheapest product in the market? Okay. The question is, did the agents know that they were selling a dodgy product? A few of the agents testified at the inquiry, and they all swore that they firmly believed that GSL was a wonderful opportunity for their customers because Mr. Sanford and Mr. Blackburn regularly told them that they had an investment genius, and that's why they were able to offer such wonderful rates. Sorry? Good? Yep, we're going to get to the capital requirements real soon. Okay, obviously this company was going to run into capital problems fairly quickly, wasn't it? First problem is, people read those investment advisory journals to see what's the best thing to invest in. Well, this product was rated number one by several investment journals. How could you not buy a product which had the cheapest rates and guaranteed high interest rates? So they had people helping them promote the product. Now, in the United States, a lot of insurance companies get ratings from AM Best, so people can check to see what the rating of the insurance company is. The problem is AM Best doesn't have any ratings for a company for the first 5 years after there's been a change of ownership. So from 1984 up till about 1989, GSL had no rating. As soon as AM Best did investigate the company, they wanted to give them a very low rating, but GSL requested that the rating not be published. And by the time this information came out, AM Best survey, at company request, no rating has been published, which would have been a tip-off, I think. It was only a few months until the company was going to collapse. So it was sort of a bit too late to protect the policyholders. Now, if I was a regulator, I would have been really worried about this because this marketing plan is almost identical to the plan used by Baldwin United, which was another company which went broke in a really big way in California in 1982. They had almost exactly the same types of products, high commission, and so on. So if the regulator had been paying attention, I think there should have been some cause for concern here. GSL was amazingly successful. They went from about
$100 million at the end of 1983 when they bought the company, up to $500 million by 1986, and they boasted in all their advertising about their wonderful growth rate. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever I see a company which has a wonderful growth rate, I immediately think there's something wrong there. What are they doing to grow so fast? In their advertising, they published this graph. They published this data showing their growth rate was the second highest in all of the 25 largest life insurance companies in the United States. The only one that was higher, of course, was Executive Life. And those of you who are familiar with American life insurance history will know that Executive Life also went broke in a big way just a couple months before GSL. So whenever you see a company boasting about its wonderful growth rates, you have to say to yourself, how come they can sell their policies at such a low rate? Now, after a while, some of the policyholders became disillusioned because GSL's actual interest rates credited were not as good as they'd expected. So they began to have difficulty in continuing their marvelous growth rate by selling lots and lots of policies to thousands of elderly retirees. So we want to switch from a retail marketing plan to a wholesale marketing plan. Isn't there a faster way to get control of large sums of money? Can you think of any way they could get hold of a lot of money really fast? Sorry?
Financial reinsurance.
That's more for cooking the books. We'll get to that later. Okay, we want to get hold of some money. I'll give you a clue. First Executive Life was following exactly the same plan, and they were also looking around for large sums of money. And their policy was to go to all the big pension funds and say, how about you arrange a buyout of all your pension fund liabilities? We'll give all of your pensioners a lifetime annuity, and all you have to do is hand over all of the money you have on reserve to pay their pensions. And we'll give you a really good deal on this. You'll even get to keep some of the surplus. Executive Life was very successful in marketing to pension funds. GSL used something called assumption reinsurance, which is a bit deceptive because it is not actually reinsurance at all. It's really just a portfolio transfer. So company ABC had a portfolio of unprofitable business with reserves of about $100 million. GSL goes along to ABC and says, we'll take liability for all those policies, and you only have to give us reserves of $90 million. You can keep the other $10 million. This looks like a pretty good deal from ABC's point of view, and from GSL's point of view, they get their hands on an extra $90 million. So those two companies are both very happy. Policyholders maybe weren't so happy. At the subsequent inquiry, one of the policyholders said, I find it appalling that I could invest my money in an A-rated company only to have that investment shunted off a few years later to a relatively new unrated company without my consent. I think he's got a point there. At the time, policyholder consent was not required, and in fact, a lot of the policyholders later said they weren't even informed that their policy had been transferred to a different company. So you might say, perhaps there was a bit of a gap in the regulations here with this assumption reinsurance policy. Was it legal? Apparently, yes. It was a bit of a grey area in the legislation, but people at the inquiry testified that it was accepted practice in the industry in the 1980s. And what was interesting is after GSL and several other companies which were in similar situations, there was a congressional inquiry into assumption reinsurance, and the industry lobby groups fought quite hard to retain the assumption reinsurance rules because basically, from their point of view, it was easy for them to get rid of unprofitable portfolios this way. So they resisted changes to the legislation.
I haven't put this on the slide, but in one of the actuarial journals that I read about assumption reinsurance, someone said to an actuary, don't you realise that this has the potential for putting policyholders into insolvent companies? And the reply was, that's what guarantee funds are for. So eventually the legislation did change, but not till 1994, when it was far too late for GSL policyholders. In the last 3 years before it went broke, GSL assumed 30,000 annuity contracts with a total value of about $280 million from four different insurance companies, which pushed their assets up close to $1 billion. I just thought I'd put in a question here about portfolio transfers. You're probably aware of Australian legislation about portfolio transfers that are designed to protect people from being moved from a solvent company to an insolvent company. I just wonder if anyone has read the Palmer report about HIH's takeover of FAI's insurance portfolio and how that got approved by APRA. If you have some spare time, you might want to have a look at that sometime to see how carefully that deal was scrutinised to see if it was in the best interests of policyholders on both sides. Okay, this is just mentioning what I said before. Executive Life, which was basically had a similar business plan to GSL, was busy ripping off pension funds around the country to take over their assets as well. If you were looking to obtain control of large sums of other people's money in Australia, where would you look? Where would there be a lot of money that no one was really keeping a close eye on? Any suggestions? Any ideas? Yeah. I was thinking along those lines too. And in particular, maybe, you know, all those eligible rollover funds that look after lost members' money. There's a whole lot of money that nobody's taking much of an interest in. There may be some other examples that you can think of as well. You can talk afterwards if you're planning this business plan. Okay, regulatory controls. They grew from $100 million in 1984 to almost $1 billion in just over 5 years. Successful company, probably up for Businessman of the Year for his wonderful success. Now, what regulations should prevent a life insurance company from doing this kind of business plan? And the gentleman up the back mentioned that that's what we have solvency requirements for. Obviously, these guys were going to have a lot of new business strain. They were selling annuity policies at very low premiums with guarantees on them. Unfortunately, GSL became quite good at managing their reported solvency. The blue line shows what they reported their solvency to be, and the pink line shows what their actual solvency was as assessed by the receiver of the company later. And you can see that there is a widening gap there. Okay, so how can we legally manage our reported solvency so that it looks so good and that we meet all the solvency requirements? Financial reinsurance. Surplus relief reinsurance, to be specific. Now, it was interesting because I asked Mr. Blackburn, who was the CEO at the time, about surplus relief reinsurance. And the senators were quite confused because they thought that reinsurance was actually supposed to protect the policyholders. And Mr. Blackburn explained that that was, you know, completely incorrect. So the senators asked, you mean this surplus relief reinsurance only protects the policyholders for a couple of days at the end of year? And Blackburn said, look, I'm not really an expert in this area. It's my impression, but I can only tell you what industry practice is. Well, Senator said, what does surplus relief reinsurance do? And basically, it allows large companies to lend their surplus to small insurance companies for a fee. And he said, it's okay, everybody does it. It's a well-known practice in the industry. The senator said, why doesn't it protect the policyholder? And he said, well, it's all just on paper. If the company were liquidated, that money wouldn't be there. So what do you think you're buying when you pay the premium? You're buying surplus that counts for statutory accounting purposes. He had a good understanding of his business. The senator said, shouldn't you get insurance that actually protects the policyholders? Isn't that your duty? And he said, look, I just follow the advice of experts and the regulators. And they said, this is okay. Technically, this is legal. The regulators allow it. Everybody else does it. There's nothing wrong with it. I haven't done anything fraudulent. This is allowed. I wasn't really concerned about the policyholders because, you know, the statutory accounting rules, they're way too conservative anyway. It's not reasonable to expect people to follow those kind of rules. And other people testified that, in fact, the use of surplus relief reinsurance to improve solvency was common in the industry and often accepted by the regulators. And, in fact, regulators would often encourage companies to use it if they were in difficulties. So, technically, they were meeting the statutory requirements. No problem at all. So I just want to ask a question here about financial reinsurance. And this may reflect my lack of understanding, but it seems to me that financial reinsurance is often used to cover up solvency problems, and it allows technical compliance to statutory solvency requirements without actually providing security for policyholders. I want to know, how do such practices become so widely accepted? I mean, after the HIH, it became clear that there were a lot of companies that were using financial reinsurance, and there were a lot of providers that were perfectly willing to, a lot of providers that were perfectly willing to provide financial reinsurance whenever anyone requested it. Now, I don't know if I just don't understand, but it seems to me that this is subverting the whole purpose of solvency requirements, and I just don't know how these practices become so widely accepted that companies which are reputable and people who have a good reputation and are professionals are supporting these kind of practices. So maybe that can be a question for discussion at the end. Is it just if everyone else is doing it, it must be okay? The regulator didn't complain, so we're allowed to do it. If it's legal, does that mean it's okay? We'll now move on to GSL's investment policy. Does anyone recognise this man? He was very influential during the 1980s, probably had more impact on the US financial system than any other individual during the 1980s. You may recognise him. His name is Michael Milken, and he was closely involved in GSL's investment policy. He was the leader of the junk bond system in the United States. So GSL had to earn high interest rates, so they invested 90% of their assets in junk bonds purchased from Mr. Milken and Drexel Burnham Lambert. What regulations should exist to prevent insurers from investing excessive amounts in high-risk assets? Solvency requirements, they should be required to keep extra capital. Anything else? Do you think we should have restrictions that prevent people from investing 90% of their assets in high-risk assets? It's allowed, isn't it, in Australia? Nothing to stop you from investing 90% of your portfolio in anything you want. Is that right? Apart from the capital requirements. Okay. Well, when the junk bonds became popular in the United States, regulators became concerned, and there were attempts in various states to limit junk bond investments. This is some comments from the New York regulator. I won't read them out, but basically it says when the regulators tried to impose some limits, there was very strong resistance, partly from Drexel, which was very good at lobbying the legislators. They went to the legislators and said, look, junk bonds are a wonderful opportunity for insurance companies to make lots of money. If you do anything to restrict this, you're just going to be reducing the returns available to policyholders. In the public interest, these companies must be allowed to invest as much as they want in junk bonds. So the New York legislature didn't pay any attention to that. They passed a limit of 20%, but in some other states, such as California, Drexel was the life insurance companies that were investing in junk bonds were able to persuade the legislators that there should be no limits. So I think the issue here is whenever a new type of investment comes up, which may be risky, you might be able to think of some risky types of investments, there's always going to be a question about should there be any legislation affecting these. And in the legislative process, there's going to be vested interests arguing on both sides of the equation. The regulator might be arguing for certain restrictions and limitations, but there will be vested interests taking the other point of view. So how does our regulatory system deal with this kind of conflict? Historically, it's always hard to impose investment restrictions when an asset is earning high returns. Now, in Florida, the regulator knew that they had 90% of money invested in junk bonds. The junk bonds produced an alluring income, and the regulator's staff was blinded by the junk bond dazzle. They said, okay, 90% junk bonds, that's okay with us. In fact, a couple of years later, the legislature did pass a law limiting junk bonds to 20%, but GSL organized a special deal for themselves to allow them to continue investing between 70 and 90% in junk bonds. They went to the regulator and said it would be difficult for us to sell down our portfolio in such a short time, especially when the market's down. So can't we just hang on to our junk bonds and we'll just sell them down really slowly over the next few years? And the regulator agreed to this. Later, when everyone was trying to blame each other for GSL's collapse, the Florida Department of Insurance was blamed that the main reason the company collapsed was because they agreed to allow GSL's junk bond holdings to continue. So, capital requirements. Obviously, we need to have strong capital requirements. If these guys are going to hold junk bonds, we need to have 20% set aside as an investment fluctuation reserve. And then the US, they call it a minimum statutory valuation reserve. And that was the law. So that should have put a crimp into GSL's investment policy plans. But GSL's response, of course, was immediately, how can we get around this regulation? And it wasn't that hard. The MSVR was calculated on the year-end balance sheet. They sold all their junk bonds to Merrill Lynch on the 31st of December, and they bought them back on the 1st of January for the same price plus a small fee. And thereby, they met their statutory solvency requirements. Was this legal? At the inquiry, the executives said, of course it's legal. We can buy and sell any assets that we want to sell. There's nothing wrong with making a deal. And according to our auditors, the transactions were properly recorded in the accounts, and the regulator knew what we were doing and didn't have any objections. So there wasn't really any, they didn't really do anything wrong. The counterparty was Merrill Lynch, and they got asked a few questions at the inquiry too. Why did they help? They said, well, we're trying to expand into the junk bond market. Drexel's got all the clients. We're trying to catch up. GSL's a big investor in junk bonds. If we can be nice to them and they give us a bit more of their business, we'll make a lot of fees. So Merrill Lynch regarded it as being helpful to a future client. Just by coincidence, this came up. A Merrill Lynch executive who helped them with this deal made a $300,000 profit on a $100,000 investment he purchased from Mr. Sanford at about the same time the deal was going through. But I'm sure that was just a coincidence. Merrill Lynch said they didn't do anything wrong. I mean, GSL couldn't have got away with what they were doing unless other financial institutions were prepared to help. Merrill Lynch said it's legal to buy and sell securities. That's our business. If the trades resulted in a misleading presentation of GSL's accounts, that's not our problem. we don't have any fiduciary responsibility to GSL's policyholders, so we don't have any liability. The Florida Department of Insurance did try and sue them, and they settled out of court for $45 million while maintaining that they hadn't done anything wrong and they were just settling to avoid all those legal expenses. The SEC censured Merrill Lynch for poor record keeping. Apparently that was the only legal thing that they'd done wrong. They backdated some of the transactions. Now the auditors, you'd think that the auditors would have had something to say about this, wouldn't you? Well, they admitted that they were aware of the year-end transactions and they knew what they were there for. Initially, they refused to sign the financial accounts, which led to them being sacked by GSL. Mr. Sanford got very irate when they said they wouldn't sign off the accounts with this information in it. But someone at Coopers & Lybrand wrote a letter back saying that surely we can reach some kind of reasonable agreement here. And eventually, CNL decided that they would sign off the statutory accounts because technically they were complying with the statutory requirements, which measured the reserves at the end of the year. The Florida Department knew about it and was okay with it. At least that's what Mark Sanford told them anyway. They didn't bother to ask the Florida Department of Insurance about this. And they hadn't done anything wrong, but they did agree to pay $50 million later to settle a lawsuit from the Florida Department of Insurance. So the question here is, can you trust auditors to be watchdogs for your financial system? I mean, our system relies heavily on the integrity of the auditors. APRA can't check every single set of accounts itself. They don't have enough staff. Can we rely on the integrity of the auditors? Are there just a few bad apples? Unfortunately, at the time this was happening, it was also the savings and loan crisis, where there were hundreds and hundreds of SNLs all over the countryside, all fiddling their accounts. And in a lot of cases, the big accounting firms were happily signing off accounts which were definitely misleading. So this isn't just an isolated incident. It's a sort of systemic problem, I think. So the question is, how much can we rely on auditors and, of course, actuaries on the liability side? And what can we do to strengthen the integrity of the auditing process? The Florida Department of Insurance said, we were deceived. We believed the accounts. We believed the audit. We believed the custodian bank's confirmations. The bank also provided some false information. Financial statements are supposed to disclose the company's financial condition, but in the case of guaranteed security life, they hid it. The Florida Department of Insurance had a really good insurance commissioner who was very good at spinning stuff at the commission, because the truth was the Florida Department of Insurance must have known what was going on. I mean, they had actually given GSL a special approval to maintain their junk bond holdings at 90%. They knew GSL had junk bonds, right? They even intervened with the legislature to get special approval for GSL. The year-end transactions, the buy and sells, were shown on the statutory returns. There was a front-page article on the St. Petersburg Times referring to these transactions. The amounts which were swapped back and forth were greater than 60% of GSL's assets. Surely this would have been noticeable. And unfortunately, they had triennial investigations by the regulator. The first draft of the triennial investigation raised the issue of these end-of-year swaps, but the final draft removed those comments, apparently at GSL's request. They didn't want to have any questions in any official documents about such things. So I think it's fairly clear that GSL knew, that regulators knew exactly what was happening with these end-of-year swaps, but they decided, well, it's easier just to go along, tick the boxes. Technically, it's okay. An independent auditing expert who commented at the inquiry said, it's easier for the regulator to just let things go, to just go along, because if you want to blow the whistle, it creates too much turbulence and too much work. GSL was by now the sixth largest insurer in Florida. Closing down a company is really difficult to do, especially if it's a big one. Regulatory forbearance means the regulators say, if we take any action, it's going to cause a run. Politics can also play a part in this kind of decision-making. So the question is, in practice, how easy would it be for a regulatory authority to revoke a large insurance company's right to sell new business? I've written FAR question mark down there because it's clear that the ISC spent a long time trying to get FAI to not sell any new business, probably for about 20 years, I think, but they were never successful in stopping FAI from staying in business. So it's difficult, and if you look at the Palmer report on APRA's actions during the HIH inquiry, you can see that there's a whole chapter on the regulation of FAI and how difficult it was for the regulator to take any effective action against such a large company. Now, you might think Mr. Sanford was just a really poor investor who got sucked in by Michael Milken to buying all these lousy securities. GSL's junk bond portfolio turned out to be really, really, really bad. 38% of their bonds were in default, and another 35% were of extremely low quality. The question was this just an honest mistake by Mr. Sanford? Sadly, Mr. Milken had an incentive scheme for his investors. When he wanted to get rid of some particularly poor investment, he would offer incentives to whoever was making the investment decision, equity sweeteners. Mr. Sanford and Mr. Blackburn made millions and millions of dollars by buying low-priced equity warrants from Mr. Milken. And when this was questioned later, there was a suggestion that these might have been kickbacks for them making bad investment decisions with GSL's money. They said, no, it was just a lucky investment. You know, we bought these warrants, and strangely enough, they, you know, went from $100,000 in value to $15 million in value, and we're just really good investors. So they hadn't actually done anything illegal that anyone could prove. Mr. Milken also assisted them by raising $150 million for their parent company. Mr. Milken was very good at pass the parcel. When one of his junk bond issues was about to collapse, he would persuade someone else to refinance by buying another issue. The people who invested money in Transmark lost all of their money and later sued because the prospectus was misleading. But, of course, there was nobody left to sue by then because Transmark was broke. So because S&Ls are covered by federal deposit insurance, that means basically the taxpayers picked up the losses for that $150 million. But this was the downfall of GSL after Mr. Milken was indicted in 1989. He cooperated with the SEC, and basically this led to the investigation of GSL. We're almost out of time. GSL had a lot of transactions with affiliates. Basically, GSL lent $36 million to an affiliate who paid $36 million in dividends to Transmark, who paid $36 million in capital supplements to GSL. Very nice little round robin. So on GSL's books, they'd have the $36 million in cash, plus they'd have the asset of $36 million in a loan to the affiliates. The trouble was the affiliates were all broke, but the auditors don't seem to have picked that up. So there they doubled their capital. Now, theoretically, you'd say that must be illegal, right? I mean, there are laws in Florida limiting investments in affiliates. You can't count investments in affiliates for solvency purposes beyond a certain limit. But if you have a good lawyer, they aren't really affiliates, you know. In fact, they had a straw man, one of their employees, who actually was the owner of the affiliate companies. And Transmark had options and warrants to buy all the shares in the affiliates, but they didn't exercise them. They had a legal agreement allowing Transmark to appoint the directors of the affiliates. Oops. So technically, Transmark was not the owner. So technically, these companies were not affiliates of GSL. So in fact, it was all 100% legal. Well, they weren't insolvent. They had $36 million in capital that they'd received. Oh, you mean... They lent the money, they lent $36 million to the affiliate, if that was shown on their books as an asset. And oh, the affiliate company, they were probably trading well and solvent, yeah. I don't know how long it took anyone to find that out. GSL? Yeah, I didn't follow that up, but you're probably true. But those companies did go broke. I don't know how long they managed to stave off bankruptcy.
There's a question at the back, Shauna.
Yep. Oh, well, Mr. Sanford, I don't know how they justified in their accounts paying those dividends. You'd think it would be difficult since they were insolvent, but they did anyway. Yeah, that's true. They did restructure this a bit later, but I don't want to go into the details. Now, the Florida Department of Insurance sued. They tried to sue the eminent Wall Street legal firm, which set up the ownership deal. The legal firm said, look, we just did what GSL asked, what Transmark asked us to do. We set up a legal structure for ownership. We didn't have anything to do with GSL's accounts. We don't know what they put in there. That's not our problem. They paid $5 million to settle the lawsuit. The auditors, CNL, knew about the deals, and they signed the accounts anyway because on legal advice, technically, these companies were not affiliates. So they didn't do anything wrong either. Does white-collar crime pay? While all this was going on for those 7 years, Sanford and Blackburn were busy looting GSL. I won't go into all the horrible details. At the time of the collapse, Mr. Sanford owned $1 million beachfront home, a powerboat, 2 Lamborghinis, a Rolls-Royce, a Corvette, a Jaguar, and a small island in the Bahamas. At the time of the collapse, I believe he was planning to build a castle on the island. I reckon it's hard to estimate exactly how much money he got out of the company, but I'd say $100 million would be a ballpark estimate. The money was held offshore in his wife's name, etc., unrecoverable. He did agree to pay about $20 million to the Florida Department of Insurance to settle outstanding lawsuits. And in return, there would be no prosecution of Sanford, his wife, or his brother, although all three were barred from the life insurance industry for life. It seems to me probable that Mr. Sanford might have had a few dollars left over, even after settling the $20 million claim. Now, I think any regulatory system depends on having effective sanctions against people who do the wrong thing. So if you look back to some of Australia's financial history and cases where insurance companies have been ripped off, the question is, have effective sanctions been applied to the people who are responsible to deter others from doing the same thing? So I'll leave you to think about whether sanctions are appropriate. Of course, the Florida Insurance Commissioner, who was a real politician, claimed that the settlement, he did manage to obtain $100 million as a settlement, was a victory for the 56,000 policyholders of the company. We will not allow insurance companies to be mismanaged or looted, leaving the policyholders to foot the bill. He was 100% right on about this, because the policyholders didn't foot the bill, the guarantee funds footed the bill. They had to pay, the state guarantee funds had to pay $180 million to cover GSL's deficit, which basically meant it pushed up the insurance premiums for everyone else in the state or pushed down the profits for every other insurance company in the state. Questions to consider. Who was responsible for GSL's losses? Apparently, no one. No one went to jail. No one admitted any wrongdoing. And everything was legal and in accordance with generally accepted accounting standards. There's almost nothing, I'm pleased to say, there's almost nothing about the actuary in any of this. I don't know what their valuation was, but the actuary seems to have been blameless. That's a relief, isn't it? I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Shauna. Has anyone got any other questions?
I don't know if there were any whistleblowers. Apparently some of the lower down people who worked in the Florida Department of Insurance did raise a few questions from time to time, but it seems that nobody took any effective action. Oh, I should mention, they do have an early warning system in the United States called IRIS, where statutory returns are kind of checked for any anomalous transactions or business growth or anything like that. And GSL did indeed come up on IRIS's early warning systems with several red flags, and I gather the Florida Department of Insurance would then send a letter to GSL saying a lot of red flags have come up, and GSL would write back and say, oh yes, we have it all under control, don't worry about that. And that was as far as it went. Sorry, I can't hear you. Yeah. Yeah, well, the only way they could have met their liability, since they were underpricing, the only way they could have met their liabilities was if they were really earning the excellent investment returns that they claimed to be earning, which worked for a while because the junk bond return market returns were really good for 3 or 4 years there in the middle 80s. The market only really crashed in 1989 when Mr. Milken went to jail, but then it crashed quite a lot. Oh, yeah, no. They were probably insolvent. They were probably insolvent from, like, 6 months after they bought the company. Yeah.
Yes, down the back.
Well, I think I raised a few issues, I hope. Okay, so... Okay. First issue is the acceptability of using financial reinsurance and other accounting tricks to make your reported solvency appear better than it is. And what I'm concerned about is how these practices become acceptable and common. And there's something wrong with the sort of ethos of the industry when... such things become common practice that people know about. Well, not... Okay, you don't agree? Sorry? Yeah, now. Yeah, maybe financial reinsurance... It's maybe not so much the issue of financial reinsurance, because now this financial reinsurance has been around since, you know, the early 1980s, and regulators have been valiantly fighting against it. The trouble is, even if they don't use financial reinsurance in the form that we recognize it in now, the problem is any kind of accounting trick which is designed to bypass solvency standards, even if it's not financial reinsurance. You know, the regulators are often just one step behind some incredibly clever financial whiz who works out a way of improving reported solvency. It's regulatory arbitrage, really. And to what extent does any form of regulatory arbitrage become acceptable is the question. So first question is, I guess, ethical standards, and then ethical standards also in the watchdogs. If professional firms providing watchdog services like auditors and actuaries to insurance companies can be so easily corrupted and sign off things which are in the grey area of accounting standards, how can this be overcome? There are always going to be grey areas. It's never possible to pin down absolutely everything. It's never possible to have a system that doesn't have loopholes. The question is, can we rely on the professionals to exploit those loopholes or stand firm against it?
We'll just have to have one last question, Martin.
I'm happy to say that the legislation did change. Junk bond restrictions were imposed in many states. Assumption reinsurance was banned a few years later, and the Florida Department of Insurance decided that they would not just check asset holdings at the end of the year on 31st of December, but would impose a continuous solvency requirement. And I believe the law about what exactly counts as an affiliate was also tightened up. So, as is usual after any kind of disaster like this, it did lead to a lot of regulatory reform.
As a special exemption, Greg can ask one final.
I know we're out of time. I would just have to say that after looking at the performance of the Florida Department of Insurance, I can only be grateful for what APRA does for Australia. I think that the system here is a lot better, it's thanks to the integrity and professionalism of our prudential regulator.
On that note, we're really going to have to leave it. We're over time, but I'd just like if you could join me in thanking Sean for a very interesting and informative session.